Welcome, everyone, to this Webfare Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is CICS Web Services Part 1 Development. CICS Web Services Part 2 Deployment will be held December 2nd, 2014. The presenter is Paul Cooper. Paul joined the CICS development team in 1998, and he has 16 years of CICS development experience. He has been an advocate of web services in CICS since the introduction of CICS Transaction Server version 3.1 and has supported many customers in the deployment and exploitation of web services in that time. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Paul.
Thank you, Kathy. Welcome, everyone. I'm Paul Cooper, and as you just heard, we'll be talking today about web services and KIX. This is the first of a two-part presentation, and the two presentations are designed to go together, so I would encourage you to come back next month for part two. In today's presentation, we'll be focusing on application development aspects of web services, whereas part two will focus more on deployment, qualities of service, that kind of thing. This presentation is actually a refreshed version of one that we gave 5 years ago in 2009. At that point in time, we were on KIX Transaction Server version 4.1, and web services were still relatively new but very popular. 5 years later, these presentations remain very useful, so we've brought them up to date for version 5.2 and everything in between. So if we move on to slide two, so the agenda today, so I'll be telling you about web services and KIX. The material will be useful for pretty much every version of KIX from 3.1 to 5.2, but I will point out any material which is specific to a particular release and above. We'll also be looking at, I mentioned, application development, the deployment of the relevant artifacts to KIX, just a little bit about testing of web services, and we'll also be looking at the comparison of both XML and JSON, two different ways of doing web services. And there'll also be customization opportunities, hints and tips, things that you can watch out for. So all sorts in there. If we can move on to slide three, please. Right, so at this point in the presentation, I like to cover something which I guess most presentations would leave to the end, but this is other sources of useful information. And we're lucky enough to have quite a wide selection of IBM Red books that describe various aspects of web services in KIX. So I've listed a load of them there, but two in particular I'd like to highlight. The first is the Application Development for KIX Web Services Red Book, and the second is Implementing KIX JSON Web Services for Mobile Applications. They're both very relevant for the discussion today. And if you want to explore the subject in more detail, they're excellent sources of information. The first of those red books, Application Development, it was updated back in 2010, so it remains somewhat current, but we're actually in the process of updating it at the moment, so it'll be even better shortly, so watch that one. The other red book on JSON Web Services was released at the end of last year, so that remains very current. At the bottom of the slide here, I've got two further links that might be of interest. The first is to some examples that we've got. They're actually a support pack. That's very useful if you are looking to write web services applications. That's got some good material to help you get started there. But the other link I think is well worth being aware of. So one at the very bottom, the knowledge collection. This is the KIX Web Services Knowledge Collection. It's a group of links that are maintained by the KICS support team, the services team. And so it contains links to all the various red books, to presentations, much like this one, various tech notes and other support materials. So it's well worth having in your bookmarks list. Can you go to slide 4, please? Okay, so what is a web service? Well, very briefly, a web service is a software component. It's available over a network. It has a defined interface of some kind. It can be accessed using technologies and services from a wide range of vendors, because it's all based on standards technology. And that's a fairly succinct definition. It seems to fit reasonably well. Within KICS, we have two main implementations of that concept. We have our XML-based web services, which have been around since Transaction Server version 3.1. And we have, quite recently, a JSON-based implementation. So that became available with the KICS TS feature pack for mobile extensions, which is available for Transaction Server version 4.2 and 5.1. And that technology is part of KICS itself as of version 5.2. Now, XML, I'm sure you know, it's very recognizable. It's angled brackets, it's begin and end tags, it's widely implemented. It has a reputation for being quite verbose, but it is very well specified. There's a whole family of specifications which are built around XML for web services, like the SOAP protocol for messaging. JSON, which is the JavaScript object notation language, it's similar. You can see it's got the same kind of ideas about it. It represents data in a similar kind of a way. Just looking at this, you can see that there are sort of curly brackets rather than angle brackets. We also get square brackets in there. And it tends to use a lot of name and value pairs or properties. So JSON tends to be a more efficient way to represent data. There's less bloat. And consequently, it's quite popular for that reason. It's also been derived from JavaScript, very popular amongst the various scripting languages that are widely used, particularly for mobile devices. So it's a very, very broad sort of rule of thumb. Tend to find that JSON tends to be the preferred choice for developers working with mobile devices, for communication with a server. But XML tends to be the more popular choice for server-to-server communication. There's no rule saying it must be like that, but just as a general positional statement, it sort of works that way. So let's move to slide number 5. Okay, so the single most common scenario for folks who are looking at KICS web services tends to involve what we refer to as bottom-up service enablement. And this is where we have an existing KICS program, does something useful, and we want to expose it to the outside world as a service. So in order to do that, we have a number of tools, offline utilities, that are distributed with KICS. We call them the assistants. And what they do is they take as input a description of the programmatic interface to a KICS program. So that's copybooks, describing the input and the output. We run that through the tool. The tool will generate some output. It generates two important artifacts. The first is something we call the WS bind file, which is a proprietary KICS artifact that, when deployed to KICS, is encapsulated within a KICS region as a web service resource. and that contains information that kicks users to perform conversions between the XML or JSON representation of the data and the application binary representation. The other kiosk file that's produced varies depending on exactly which of the assistants we're running, but typically, if we're talking about XML and SOAP-based web services, we'll be generating something called a WSDL document. That's a web service description language document. So we have these tools. The main one is DFH LS to WS, that's language structure to WSDL, which generates the WSDL document. We also have a DFH LS to JS that generates JSON schema, and that's available with the mobile feature pack. The feature pack for mobile extensions from 4.2. And we have LS to SC, which is language structure to XML schema. That's been available since Transaction Server version 4.1. And that's used for programmatic scenarios. If you want to programmatically convert a block of XML into application-style data or back again. So on this particular slide, I've got on the right there just a fragment of one of my unit test cases. It's not particularly representative of a real application, but I refer back to this a few times later on in the presentation. We have fairly good coverage in the Kix tools of the type of data that you can find in a copybook, but there are some restrictions, unfortunately. And so on this slide, I do list a few of them. Pointers are a pretty good example of that. We can't support copybooks with pointers as part of the data declaration. Similarly, level 66 clauses in COBOL, and there's limited support for picture clauses. I mean, we support the most common variants of picture clauses, but you can construct some which the tooling will reject. And that's a statement that changes over time. So, for example, the version of this presentation we gave back in 2009 listed the COBOL occurs depending on clause there as an important limitation, whereas that's something that is supported now as of version 5.2. So, over time, the list of restrictions has been reduced. I probably should just say as well that we support application interfaces defined in COBOL, in PL1, and C or C++. Let's move to slide 6. So on this slide, I'm just showing you an example of a WSDL document. That's a web service description that's been generated by DFH LS to WS, language structure to WSDL. Now, the fragment is deliberately too small for you to conveniently read here. That's deliberate. And the point I'm trying to make here is that whilst it is an XML document and therefore is, in some sense, human readable, it's not really intended for you to read directly. It's really intended to be used in combination with tooling. So this WSDL document gets generated, and it contains a whole load of information in it that tools can use to generate code to allow interaction with the deployed service. So the kind of information we've got in there includes descriptions of each individual field in the programmatic interface, you know, what the range of values are that are supported, validation rules, that kind of thing. It also has some transport-specific binding information, which specifies that this particular service is going to be addressed using a particular version of the SOAP protocol, that's a messaging protocol, over HTTP, or that kind of thing. And very importantly, it also has the location of the service on the network, the actual network endpoint at which the service can be found. And so I've got a small fragment of the WSDL there that I've magnified. It just describes one particular field from the copybook on the previous slide. And you can see that in this particular case, the field is called Single Float 2. It has a data type of XSD float. That's in the XML schema definition language. You don't need to know what that means, but that's the kind of information that you find within a whistle document. It's everything that a client-side developer should need to be able to generate requests and to understand responses from the service. Slide 7, please. Okay, so the interface to these assistants, I say they're offline utilities, which have a JTL-based interface. So that means that you can call the assistants from JTL, and that in turn can be integrated into build systems, it can be archived for reuse later on. I've got a brief example there. There's a great long list of parameters that can be optionally specified when you run the assistants. I'm not going to bore you by going through the details of what they all mean, because that reference information is readily available in the information center, like the knowledge center. But what I will just mention is that in addition to the JTL-based interface, we also have a Java-based API, a programmatic interface. The assistants are actually implemented in Java and do require a Java virtual machine to run it. But one of the advantages of that is that they're not particularly tied to the platform. So, for example, Rational Developer for System Z includes wizards that make use of the assistants programmatically to generate artifacts. So there are some clever things you can do in that area if you're not keen on the JTL-based interface. Let's move to slide 8. Right, so some other considerations in this type of scenario, this bottom-up scenario. We can link to target programs that have either a common area-based interface or a channel-based interface. In the case of channels, we have a technology that was introduced back in Transaction Server version 4.1 called the Channel Description Document. That allows you to describe a channel-based interface for a program, and you can list a whole load of named containers and individually declare the content model for those containers, whether they're text, whether they're binary, whether they're a structured record, whether they're optional, whether they're mandatory, that kind of information. If you choose to do that, we can then provide a web services-based interface to those channel-based programs. This bottom-up scenario, it's always what we call provider mode. Provider mode meaning that Kix is acting in the role of a server rather than of a client. And there would normally be an existing Kix application that we're exposing. Now, threat results, I do encourage the use of thread-safe applications. It's certainly not mandatory. It will work fine without thread safety. But the Kix infrastructure for web services does run on an open TTB. So if you do have thread-safe applications, then you can avoid a TTB switch there. So, yeah, it's a good thing to be thread-safe, but not mandatory. So I've mentioned Rational Application Developer for System Z, or RDZ, as I'll probably call it hereafter. RDZ is a development environment that IBM provides. You don't have to use it by any means. I'm just pointing out that it exists because it does have some very useful tools for working with Kix Web Services. Amongst other things, they actually have two technologies by which Kix programs can be exposed as web services. The first is the technology I've just been mentioning, which is the Kix supplied interpreted file of web service. So under the covers, although you get nice pretty wizards and you can do some clever things in there, it's fundamentally driving the technology from DFH LS to WS, the manually structured to Wurstl assistance. But they also have a complementary technology called compiled converters. Now what that does is it's a completely different implementation of the concept. It generates source code of converter programs, which you can then compile up and deploy to the Kix region, and those converter programs will convert between application style data and XML. Both technologies have a similar performance characteristic, but one of the nice things about the compiled technology is that it has a much broader support for base COBOL. So if you do find yourself running up against the limitations of what DFHLS to WS supports, you may find that those compiled converters get you beyond that. The other thing I should really just mention is that although these two technologies have similar mappings into XML, they're not identical. And so that means you can't just swap out one technology for the other without there being some kind of client-side change. So it's absolutely fine to mix both usage patterns within the same KIX region. You can have some services which use the KIX interpreted approach and some which use the compiled approach. And both involve the deployment of the WS bind file. And so they have similar management characteristics within a KIX region. Let's go to slide 9. Okay, so I'm just going to show you some screenshots of the wizards that are there within RDC, because it's far more visual and easier to understand than showing you fragments of JPL. So I'm using RDC version 9.1 here. 9.1 is quite nice. It's actually been updated to support JSON, interpreted JSON. So what we do is we start off by creating a web services for KIX project, give that a name. There are three different usage scenarios that RDC supports. The bottom-up scenario, which is what I'm talking you through at the moment. The top-down scenario, which is where you start with a WSDL-based description of a service and generate artifacts. And something called Meet in the Middle, which is quite an interesting variant, which is where you have both an existing application and a new service description, and you kind of want to map the two onto each other, and you can draw sort of wires between different fields of the WSDL and the COM area, and it'll generate you a program which will handle that. So input files have to be loaded into the workspace within RDC. They can come locally, they can come from remote repositories. Let's go to slide 10. Thank you. So the next thing you do, having loaded, in this case I've loaded my copybook up within the RDC workspace, I can right click on the project and tell it that I want to generate a web services for KIX resource. I'm actually within a part of RDC called the Enterprise Service Tools, incidentally, just in case you wanted to know. Slide 11, please. Okay, so within RDC, there's all these same configuration options for, you know, setting various different parameters for involving yourself in the mapping decisions that the assistants make. But one of the nice capabilities that it does have, which doesn't really exist in the JPL-based interface, is the ability to select individual fields from your copybooks for inclusion or exclusion from the web service. So by default, we exclude filler fields. They're not interesting to the external service. But if you know that you have some fields in there which may be input only and other fields which are output only, or some fields which for legacy reasons are still there but not part of the service, you can remove them. And the bind file that's generated will describe a service without those fields, but you know, KIX will know that there are gaps in the COM area there that should be jumped over. So that can be quite useful. I'll say that the JPL-based interface doesn't have that fine-grained ability to make mapping decisions on a per-field basis. So it's a little bit of additional capability that RDC provides. Yes, and the change COBOL preferences button there, that's where you can click to go and change all the defaults for the mapping decisions. There are a wealth of parameters you can set which between them affect the mappings in one way or another. If there's ever a situation where you don't like one of the mapping decisions that's been made automatically by the assistant, you may well find there's a parameter which will help you control that. Anyway, if we go to slide 12, please. So in the end of this wizard for generating the artifacts, one of the nice things in RDC is it has the ability to actually deploy the generated artifacts into a live test region, a KIX region. It does that using the same CNCI-based technology from the KIX Explorer. So what I've got here is it's actually connected to my KIX region. It's had a look and it's identified a whole load of pipeline resources. I've not mentioned pipeline resources yet, but a pipeline is basically a container for web services. It's a KIX resource which can be used to instantiate web service resources. And so I have a number of pipelines defined in my KIX region. I've selected one of them here. It actually has something called a pickup directory associated with it, a web services directory. And what it will do is, having selected this particular pipeline, RDC will generate the bind file, will deploy it to the KIX CFS file system. The appropriate directory for this particular pipeline, it will then cause the pipeline to perform a scan action. So within KIX, that actually causes the bind file to be read into memory and turned into a web service resource. So the act of doing that causes the bind file we've just generated to become live in our test environment. And then that in turn means, of course, we can then start actually using it. So let's go to slide 13. So there are many ways you can go about testing a web service. What I'm going to demonstrate here is using something called the Web Services Explorer, which is part of the Web Tools project within Eclipse. It's there for you to use within RDC, should you be using RDC. And there are many other tools that exist out there that folks like to use. But what I can do within RDC is I can right-click on the WSDL document that I've just generated. I can tell it I want to open it, I want to test it in the Web Services Explorer, and that will generate me a form. Based on all those fields from the WSDL, it will generate me a form with input fields, and you can type values in. So what we're seeing on the right-hand side of the screen here is that for each field in the service, I can enter a value. Those fields which have a little red asterisk beside them are mandatory fields. I must provide a value. And the link down at the bottom of the slide there points to a tech note where we discuss using this test framework in more detail. That I can enter some test values here. In the top right, there's a little button, a little link called Source. I can click on that. And let's get to slide 14. Having clicked on Source, I will see an XML representation of what's being generated. So in this particular example, I typed in a whole load of fairly random values. I clicked that Source button, it showed me what they would look like in XML. And around the edges of our XML block, there's a little bit of a SOAP envelope that you can see. The SOAP envelope is part of the messaging protocol. You shouldn't need to worry about that too much, but it's there and providing an extra little bit of information. So what's going to happen, of course, there's a button at the bottom of the screen there called Go. If I were to click on Go, the test client here is going to open a connection up to KIX at the URI that was defined there within the WSDL document. It's going to send the generated SOAP message to KIX. KIX is going to receive that. It's going to convert that XML payload into application data using the rules that were defined in the bind file that we deployed. Having generated the application data, it's going to link to the target application, the name of which is also in the bind file. The application then runs and does whatever it is that it does, passes back some kind of response, which KIX will then convert back into this XML format, embed within a SOAP envelope, and send back to the client. And, you know, it can be that simple. back when we first introduced web services back in 3.1, that the marketing message was around single-day web service enablement. But in many cases, it can be a good deal faster than that. So as I've mentioned, there can be things that get in the way, and of course, Kix probes can fail, and we've got error cases to deal with. Your probe can bend and various other things, but by and large, Golden Path can be very straightforward. So that talks briefly about the XML-based interface. On slide 15, if we go there, I've got a similar slide to describe a JSON-based interface. So I mentioned that we have a different tool, DFHLS to JS, generating the JSON schema-based interface of service. JSON schema, as a standard, is still evolving. At this moment in time, the most recent version of the draft specification is still at version 4 draft level. So that's the level of JSON schema that we're generating, but it's reasonable to assume that at some point in the future that will continue to evolve. JSON schema itself, we have an example here on the right of what's being generated from my copybook, or the start of it at least. We have one schema generated for the request message, a second one for the response message. There's nothing which pulls all that together into one place, quite the equivalent of the WSDL document for SOAP services. But we do have the ability to handle all that in Kix, so we can deploy these JSON bind files to, say, version 4.2 or above. Oh, and within Rational Developer for System Z, as of version 9.1, it also has support for this JSON generation in interpreted mode. It calls the equivalent of DHLS to JS under the covers. So all those capabilities we just saw for XML, they're also there for JSON. Now, we can deploy these generated bind files to Kix. One of the interesting things we can also do is Kix Transaction Gateway, version 9.1. It supports JSON WS bind files being deployed actually to TG, to Kix Transaction Gateway itself. And if you do that, those conversions to COM area style data, they're happening within the Transaction Gateway's address space. And then Transaction Gateway communicates with Kix using, whichever communication technology you set up, sort of ECI. But that's particularly interesting because it can, of course, also be used to target Kix series or older versions of Kix TS. So there's an interesting option there. And it's the same WSBind-based technology for doing that. We also support these same WS bind files in a separate product called Zeos Connect. That's a web server Liberty profile-based application. You deploy bind files there, and it will communicate with Kix using Wova. But however you deploy your JSON bind files, ultimately you'll want to test them. There are various JSON clients. Unfortunately, there aren't many out there which work particularly well with JSON schema not being widely deployed and supported by tooling yet, but nonetheless it's getting there. But one particular test app that I just mentioned here is the Postman Chrome app. So one of the things we find with JSON schema, as I say, the protocol itself is not widely deployed, though it is improving. What we tend to find is that designers of JSON APIs tend not to use schemas. They tend to document their APIs by use of examples. And so that in turn tends to result in an interactive style or approach to developing clients of web services. There tends to be a sort of a trial and error approach to it, which is quite different from how we see things with XML, where you just generate some code and it all works. So it's different approaches, but both are valid. Let's go to slide 16. Okay, so we've generated our bind file, we've produced a WSDL or JSON schema, job done, right? Well, you can take the Wolf Door schemas that you just produced and publish them to the outside world if you wish to do so. But what I tend to encourage is customization of the Wolf Door. So, as an example, you might find that it's suitable to change the field names within the Wolf Door. Those field names, of course, are all derived from the field names in the COBOL copybook, and that may or may not be suitable for the outside world to understand. There may be other names there within the Wolf Door, names of the service, of the operation, of XML namespaces, things that you might want to change. There could be content in there that you actually want to remove, such as fields that you know aren't relevant. You may have a more sophisticated requirement. Perhaps you want to combine several Wolf Door documents into one composite service. Or maybe you want to add fields to make it easier to support version control in the future. For example, you could have artifacts there in the Wolf Door which will make it possible for you to add additional fields in the future without requiring client-side changes. That can be done. So, generally speaking, I'd encourage these generated Wolf Door documents to be customized, so that instead of having a sort of machine-generated default, you have the interface that you would be proud to share with your client-side development team, or your customers, or your business partners, or whoever they may be. If you choose to do that, of course, that invalidates the information that's in the WSBI file. So the thing you then have to do is to reprocess that modified Wolf Door through the top-down tooling, which is what I'll be telling you about shortly. The top-down tooling takes as input Wolf Door, produces as output a WSBI file, but also copybooks. And depending on what you changed, those new copybooks may or may not be compatible with what you started with. If all you've done is change field names, there's a good chance that they will be. But if you've restructured things and made more significant changes, they may not be. So you then have a decision. You either have to evolve the existing traditional COBOL program to implement the new interface, or you write a wrapper program that maps between the new interface and the existing interface. And that wrapper program may just be a whole load of COBOL move statements. But I suppose the point here is that although taking this approach will result in a neater service from an outside perspective, it does involve considerably more work. Consequently, in my experience, this isn't a technique that's widely used. I encourage it, I think it's a good thing, but in practice, maybe not. If you do take this approach of modifying the generated Wolf Door, it's a good idea to thereafter consider the Wolf Door document itself to be the primary document to describe the interface of the service. So future changes would be designed in from the Wolf Door downwards rather than from the COBOL upwards. So let's move to slide 17. Mapping levels. Mapping levels are something you come across with web services for Qix. It's actually a sort of a version control mechanism from the point of view of the version of the mappings that Qix generates for a particular web service. And the reason why a mapping level is important is that it allows the Qix development organization to introduce new and improved mapping changes over time without breaking your ability to regenerate your existing services in a way that continues to generate what it always used to do in the past. So the reason why that's useful is that if you have archived JCL and you want to regenerate a service for some reason, maybe you want to change the URI that it's exposed down to something deployment related like that, you can do so, and we ensure that the bind file that's produced and the Wolf Door that's produced is the equivalent of what would have been produced originally when you first did that potentially some years ago. So every time the development team here in Hursley introduces new changes, we make some kind of opt-in. And at a release boundary, that opt-in would often be a new mapping level. So you can see over time we've had quite a few mapping levels introduced. As of version 5.2, we introduced mapping level 4.0. The main new capabilities in there are support for UTF-16 data and support for the COBOL occurs depending on clause. As a general rule, we'd encourage you to use the most recent mapping level that's available for you for new applications. But obviously you don't have to. But for existing applications, I would suggest that, sorry, for existing services, I would suggest that you use whatever mapping level you used to in the past. There's no point in changing the interface or changing the mapping level. Let's move to slide 18. Okay, so I've been talking about this bottom-up strategy for enabling existing Qix programs. We can also work top-down, where we start with a description of a service, typically a WSDL document. We could be talking JSON schema, we could be talking XML schema. We generate artifacts that allow you to write a program that either implements the described service or can invoke a remote service with that particular interface. So our tools here are assistants, DFHWS to LS, that's WSDL to language structure. We also have DFHJS to LS, JSON schema to language structure, and DFHSC to LS, XML schema to language structure. Those tools generate the equivalent, the opposite of what the bottom-up tools generated. So they generate the bind file, but also language structures. Now, one of the things I've just been recommended on this slide, if you are starting with a WSDL document, I would encourage you to use a validating editor, such as the editors in RDZ and Eclipse, because they can save you some time and effort. Certainly in the early days of web services and Qix, we did have quite a lot of PNRs being raised from situations where folks had hand-edited WSDL and introduced problems, and sometimes it was rather difficult to figure out quite what further on down the stream when running the assistants. So there are really good editors out there for WSDL and for XML, and it's a good idea to use them. In this particular example, I've deliberately injected an error just to show you that it flanks the error up. Let's get to slide 19. Okay, so something to be aware of. The act of mapping WSDL into COBOL tends to result in a more complex COBOL description of the data than we started with in the WSDL. So in some cases, you'll find that a single field in your WSDL might result in two fields being generated into the COBOL. In some cases, we might end up having to generate additional Qix contains with extra information in them. So what we tend to find is that the COBOL is more complicated than the WSDL. And so if you start off with complex WSDL, you'll result in very complex COBOL. So as far as possible, I'd encourage you to keep your WSDL as simple and straightforward as you can. I know the real world doesn't work like that, but it will make things easier for application developers if such a thing is possible. And not only that, but simple interfaces will perform a good deal better, and we'll see that in a moment. If you are using a Russian developer system Z, it not only generates you COBOL copybooks, it will also generate you a small bit of template code to help you get started on writing your program or invoking your remote service. The copybooks that are produced, they do contain a whole load of comments and annotations which try to help the developer to understand how those fields in the copyleft book relate to the fields of the service that they're calling or implementing. As I've mentioned already, there are lots of options in the tooling to tweak how data mapping occurs. So there's lots you can explore there. But this is slide 20. Okay. So I mentioned performance. There is definitely a cost associated. associated with complexity. So with web services, one of the nice things about it is that we're not limited in the length of data in any way. So you can, if you want to do so, send, you know, hundreds of megabytes of data. It can be made to work, but it's never going to perform in the same way as this UK commerce is. So yes, you can escape that limitation. You can send as much data as you want, but I would still encourage you to keep data packets small and concise if you can. And related to that, the complexity of data, the number of nested levels, the number of XML tags, has a measurable effect on the performance. It's just, you know, searching for angle brackets, but nonetheless, it adds up. So if you have the option to do so, keeping your XML simple and small, definitely good things. And there's a link to a red paper there that discusses that in more detail. So one aspect of this, which is kind of a little bit interesting, is that a typical web service, if such a thing exists, will tend to involve sort of a query-type operation, a small request payload and a much larger response payload being sent back again. Now, when KIX is acting in a provider role as a server, it's receiving and parsing a fairly small message and generating a much larger one. That tends to work quite well in KIX's favour. It makes things look nice and efficient. But as soon as you swap the roles around and have KIX acting as a service requester in a client-based role, it's sending a small request and receiving potentially a much larger response back that has to be passed through. And so that can look more expensive in KIX just because we're doing a lot more of that parsing work. Anyway, that's just an observation, something to be aware of. Simple interfaces, small amounts of data will perform better. Slide 21, please. Okay, so if we look specifically at requester mode, this is where KIX is acting as a client. First of all, we have an API command just for doing that. It's only for SOAP-based web services. We do have an equivalent for JSON, which I'll mention in a moment. But for SOAP-based web services, we can issue exec KIX invoke service. If you choose to use that, I would encourage you, when you generate your bind files, to list the specific list of operations from the WSDL that your service is going, well, that you want to call on this remote service. And the reason for doing that is that WSDL service can have many operations, and it's just a waste of resources to generate mappings for all of them if many of them aren't going to be used. So you can save some resources if you only enable the operations you specifically want to call. We can set timeouts for those requests to remote services. As of transaction service version 3.2, you set the timeout from the pipeline resource that I mentioned earlier. There's also a slightly more complicated mechanism for setting them on a per request basis. But it's a good idea to have that timeout. The URI that identifies the location of the remote web service, I encourage you to store that in a client mode URI map resource in KIX. And then in your application programs on the invoke service command, you actually reference the URI map resource by name. And that provides a level of indirection for discovering the URI of the remote service. And that's quite useful, partly because you can then change where the service points to fairly easily, declaratively using a KIX resource. But it also gives you the ability to set security characteristics, SSL filters, that kind of thing on the URI map. So you can do that from version 4.1 or above. In older versions of KIX, the trick is to either store the URI within the application program itself, hard-coded, or within the bind file, or indeed it can even be set from a handler program in the pipeline, but that's a bit more exotic. So let's go to slide 22. Right, so continuing the sort of requester mode, I just mentioned site configurations for transport layer security. So the best plan is to set them in the URI map, a client mode URI map. But if you are using version 3.1 of KIX, you'll end up using the default sizes that are associated with the region. If you're on version 3.2, you have an additional option. You can generate a client mode URI map, which Kix will then find based on the URI that you've provided to whichever other mechanism you're using, which is a slight rigmarole, but it can be made to work. Now, if you're using JSON rather than SOAP, the equivalent that we have is there's a programmatic channel-based program you can call which will perform programmatic JSON conversions on your behalf. So you can put data into a set of containers, call dfxjson, it'll perform the conversion, give you the result back in another container, and you can then use the ExecKix web API to make outbound calls using the JSON or that you've generated or by returning JSON to parse. So you can do that, but it's not as neatly integrated as the invoke commands that we have for SOAP. Slide 23, please. Okay, so the other scenario we have when working top-down is provider mode. And this is where you're going to write a new Kix program that implements a service that's been described by a WSDL document or JSON schema. So it's very similar to the bottom-up approach, except, of course, that we're creating a new program, and that new program will know that it is being deployed as a web service. So consequently, it has the option, if it wishes to do so, of interacting with Kix to better perform whatever it's trying to do. So we have a whole load of containers, we call them control containers, that are passed to the application from Kix, which the application can use if it wishes to help understand the context of what it's doing. One example that I've mentioned here is dfxws-operation. That particular container holds the name of the particular WSDL operation that's currently being invoked. The application might use that if there are many operations to determine which set of copybooks to overlay over the input data, that kind of thing. There's a whole load of these containers. Again, there's lots of reference information in the docs to learn more about that. One of the useful capabilities here is we have an ExecKix SOAP fault API, which applications can use to generate application-specific fault messages. That's error responses in the SOAP protocol for XML-based web services. And I should just mention in passing that if an application does a bend, then Kix will automatically generate you fault messages as best it can. Slide 24, please. So there are two styles of web service that we support. Request response, which is our sort of our normal approach, and RESTful. Now, request response is, the request message is sent in, the response message is sent out, they're paired together. It's very much traditional Kix applications. It's a remote procedure call. And that's your only option if you're using SOAP. But with JSON, we do have another option. With JSON, we have RESTful mode. Now, RESTful services are kind of an interesting new idea from a Kix point of view. They're not an obvious fit. RESTful services are data-orientated, and there are a specific list of actions that you can perform against them. And each instance of the data will have its own URI that individually addresses it. So a particular instance of data can be created using a HTTP POST action. It can be queried using HTTP GET. You can change it using a HTTP PUT. And you can delete it using HTTP delete. And so depending on the specific HTTP method that's used, the target application program will do a different thing. So again, there's a control container that the application can use to understand which method is being driven. Quite what the program then does is entirely up to it. Maybe it's writing state to a VSAN file or to a TSQ or whatever. So anyway, the observation here is it's only for JSON. It's by definition a new application. It's something new, and it can only be generated top-down as well. Let's move on to slide 25. Okay, so we can also support what we call XML-aware applications. These are applications that, for whatever reason, choose to work directly with the XML of a SOAP-based service themselves. So we opt out of all of the data mapping support, but nonetheless, the application will be able to receive the XML payloads and SOAP message, do whatever it does, and provide an XML response to send back again. And there are various ways that can be done, but the method I would encourage is using the XML-only parameter of WS2LS. So what that does is it generates a WS bind file that tells Qix not to perform any conversions, but to just pass the XML through to the application. And the application itself will be responsible for parsing the XML data, doing whatever it does, generating the response to one of the control containers. But the advantage of using that particular approach over any of the others is that you have a shared deployment model. You still have that with web service resource that's there for monitoring, for statistics, and for validation, and the invoke command, and all these good things. So that comes together. Where it can be useful is perhaps if you have custom XML conversion routines, perhaps you're using, vendor products for doing conversions, that kind of thing. There are many other technologies out there for XML which you can choose to integrate with Qix Web Services using this kind of technique. So slide 26, please. Okay, well, sadly, it's still true that there are some WSL documents that are unsupported by our tooling, by VFHWS2LS. Probably the most common example of that is where WSL documents contain a recursion, so an instance of something contains further instances of itself. That's something that VFHWS2LS does not currently support. If you do come across issues like that, there are various ways you can work around it. Of course, one of which is to use the to work directly with the XML as described on the previous slide. Another option, which is well worth being aware of, is as of Transaction Server version 4.2, we support Java-based services in Qix using the Java API for XML Web Services or JAX-WS. And because the mapping between XML schema and Java is so much more complete and so much more natural than it is with COBOL, you could choose to generate a Java program that implements your service and then have it do whatever it needs doing and ultimately using the JKX API to interact with the rest of your environment in Qix. So JAX-WS is quite a useful technique for working around some of those limitations, or indeed for implementing more complicated services in Qix where you have an existing WSL document to describe them. And there's a link there to an article that discusses that in more detail. Let's go to slide 27. I've mentioned the WS bind file several times. They contain the metadata that facilitates the data transformations, but they also contain some deployment information. They have the URI at which the service is deployed. They can, in provider mode in particular, they'll have the name of the program that you link to. They can optionally contain the transaction ID under which the service is going to run. They can optionally contain a default user ID to use in the absence of any other authentication credentials. Now, you can actually view some of the contents, and indeed edit some of the contents, of a bind file from within RDZ. So on slide 28, let's go there, we can see that happening. So here, I've right-clicked on a WS bind file within RDZ, and it's opened up the editor. And we can see various pieces of information in there, and there's a few fields we can actually change. So that can be useful. You can find it's useful to be able to get in there and change, for example, the URI under which services are invoked. There's a support pack, CS04, which will allow you to do the same thing from a command line-based interface. The kind of things you can change are the URI, the name of the target program, the default transaction ID, the default user ID, and the sync on return flag. Let's go to slide 29. Okay, I'm not going to dwell very long on the kicks, on the deployment aspect here, but there are four resources it's worth being aware of. Within kicks, we have the TCP/IP service resource. That's something that you typically create once and is shared by many, many different web services. It's kind of describing the port number at which KIX is listening for work to arrive. It identifies the associated protocol on that port as being, in this case, HTTP. Above that, we have a URI map resource. And that's a very important resource in KIX, which associates a particular URI with the type of processing that's supposed to happen downstream. And so in my example here, I have a URI map resource which indicates usage equals pipeline. This is going to be for web services. It actually names a particular pipeline that's going to perform that work, and it names a particular web service resource which is also going to be involved in performing that work. So the TCP/IP service is kind of at the level of KIX sockets domain. The URI map is at the level of KIX web domain. The pipeline resource sits above that. It receives control. It's going to identify the shared qualities of service. It's responsible for things like security and transactionality and those kinds of things. Again, a pipeline is typically shared by many, many web services. As we get through that layer of processing, we reach the web service resource in KIX. The web service is the guy that was instantiated from our WFBI file. It actually points at the WFBI file, and it wrappers the target KIX application. So it knows the name of the specific program that will be attached. So go to slide 30, please. So for each web service that we want to deploy, we're going to need a unique web service resource and a URI map resource. Those two get deployed together and work together as a pair. Now, I've already mentioned that we can deploy those services to KIX. To pick up directory of a pipeline resource, we can scan them into existence, causes of any bind files that have been deployed to pick up directory or have changed to be loaded into memory. And that's a very useful technique, it's widely used, but you don't have to use that. If you prefer, you may choose instead to use traditional resource definitions. You can opt out of that scan entirely. You can define web service resources and URI map resources manually if you want to do so. But if you do use the scan mechanism, then KIX will usually create those resources for you based on what was in the bind file. Oh, and as of Transaction Service version 5.2, we also support cloud-style deployments where definitions are stored within KIX bundle resources. So that's new in 5.2. Let's go to slide 31. Okay, so I've just got a few slides now where I'll describe some of the key changes from one release to the next in web services. So in Transaction Service version 3.2, firstly, it was a good deal faster than 3.1 for web services. If you are still on 3.1, you can expect a noticeable performance improvement by moving up to 3.2 around web services. And part of that was about changes in code page conversion in 64-bit containers, in thread safety, lots of little things. There's a whole lot more in the way of data mapping capabilities that were introduced at 3.2, various sort of quality of service type specifications that we added there. Let's go to slide 32, please. So in Transaction Server version 4.1, once again, there was a noticeable performance improvement. Not quite as much as going to 3.2, but nonetheless a useful thing to have. That was largely by a rewrite of the SOAP terminal handler in KIX. Now, a small part, I really should emphasize that it's a very small part of the total path link, also became offloadable to the Z application assist processor as part of that work. It's so small that I wouldn't want you to particularly be disappointed if it's not as much as you expect. It is a small amount, but nonetheless, it's again a step in the right direction. More data mapping options were introduced, including support for channel description documents I mentioned earlier. We also introduced an XML processing API. So you can programmatically transform blocks of XML into application-style data or back again. And that can be very useful in some of the more advanced scenarios where you're writing pipeline handler programs and you're working with dynamic XML content and various other clever things. So if you do wish to programmatically do conversions, that API exists from 4.1. We also have support for WS addressing at 4.1. Let's go to slide 33, please. So transaction server version 4.2, one of the main things there is we now have the KubeCS feature pack for mobile extensions, which introduces the JSON support. We also have support for JAXWS, that's the Java API for XML Web Services. That came along in 4.2 as part of our support for Java-based SOAP pipelines. So that's there. And we also have another feature pack, the Security Token Extensions feature pack, which introduces some support for SAML security tokens. That's all around 4.2. Next slide, please. 34. In version 5.1, one of the big changes there around web services was some enhancements to the APIs for containers. So in 5.1, you can actually append to an existing container. That's very useful. And you can also read a container in a sort of windowed or chunked form. And that's very useful for some of the top-down scenarios, where the assistants will generate interfaces which involve iterating across the contents of a container. So particularly if you're coding in COBOL, those API enhancements can prove very, very useful for KubeCS Web Services. We have improved support, I would say, for the Java API for XML Web Services through use of WebSphere Liberty Profile in 5.1, and indeed support for JAX-RS, which is the Java API for RESTful services, which includes support for JSON. So there's more things in that area too. Slide 35, please. So now new in KubeCS Transaction Server version 5.2. The main thing there, or the most obvious thing, is mapping level 4.0. That introduces support for UTF-16. So that's where you have national picture clauses in COBOL, PL1, there's an equivalent to C. So you can actually have interleaved within a single COM area fragments of EBSphere and UTF-16, and the assistants will deal with that and KubeCS will cope with that in a lossless fashion. So that was particularly useful. And we've also added in support there for the occurs depending on clause from COBOL, which was another a common request for enhancement. Further security enhancements around Kerberos, around support for cipher suites, cloud-style deployment, that's all good stuff. Slide 36, please. Okay, almost at the end. So as a summary, kind of things I hope you take away from this presentation. KubeCS has a first-class web services endpoint. It's a hugely customizable stack. There's lots of things I've not been able to tell you about today, lots more you can read about in the Red Book or in the Knowledge Center. And, of course, do please come back next month where we'll tell you all about those qualities of service. Web services, fundamentally, it's about interoperability. Products and services from different vendors, it sort of escapes the lock-in to some extent of proprietary technology. And so you can choose which tools you want to use. I've been talking about rational development for System Z, but you can choose to use whatever tools are suitable for you, industry standard technology, best of breed tooling. There's a whole ecosystem of products out there which add value around web services as well. So lots of things that you can do. Anyway, as I said, do please come back next month where we'll continue looking at security and some of the technologies around the deployment of KubeCS Web Services. But I think let's go to slide 37.
Thank you, Paul, for a great presentation. Moving on to the Q&A sessions.
We currently have no questions in queue.
Okay. I do not see any questions in the group chat. So, at this point, we will conclude this session. Thank you very much for joining us today, and thank you, Paul, for presenting. You all have a great day.